This episode is sponsored by...
Hey there, I'm Patrick Hines.
And I'm Jillian Pensavalli.
And we are the hosts of a new podcast called True Crime Obsessed. Each week, we break down a popular true crime documentary, like The Keepers or Mommy, Dead, and Dearest, and we chat about it in a fun and interesting way.
We also have a ton of fun, and let's be real, we edit the hell out of our episodes. Well, Patrick does. So Patrick, play a clip of us being funny or something. And at one point, she's like, who am I to tell this family that they're not... related? And I'm like, you're the FBI, Nancy. That's who you are. Like, if anyone right. has any right to tell these people that I'm so sorry to tell you this, but this is he's a mass imposter who's wanted by Interpol and who does this on the regular. Like, you, Nancy, just tell them. Joe Maskell looks like one of the many sketches of the Zodiac Killer, which is totally appropriate.
Have we ever seen the two of them in the same room together? Well, did we just solve the Zodiac case?
I think we did.
We didn't even mean to.
Oh my God.
So if you're serious about true crime, but you also love to laugh, give us a try. Find True Crime Obsessed anywhere you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. A woman, mentally broken, wanted to end her life. A single mother who felt she had nowhere left to turn. That is until one March day, where the world of Judy Kirby would come crashing down. Okay, on to the show.
I want to know why. I love my babies. I wouldn't do nothing to hurt my babies. I swear to God in heaven I wouldn't. I wouldn't. I swear to God that is all I love. I wouldn't do nothing to hurt my babies. None of my babies.
This is a statement that Judy Kirby made to police on March 25th, 2000, after a fatal car crash while she lay in a hospital bed recovering from her injuries. Police accused Judy of recklessly driving on the wrong side of I-67 in Martinsville, Indiana. They also had informed her that she took 7 lives. 3 of them were her children, 1 was her nephew, and 3 others were complete strangers. While Judy's state of mind is going to be questionable throughout this episode, it's irrefutable that she caused the car accident that took the lives of 7 people, 6 of them children. 7 months before the crash, Judy gave birth to her 8th biological child and 10th child overall. She had also had 2 adopted children living with her. Despite what should have been a happy occasion, Judy's mental health had deteriorated. Her relationship with Tenney Kirby, the father of her 2 youngest children, was on the rocks due to his infidelity. She had caught him cheating, and she was tired of it. She believed that he was no longer attracted to her because of what pregnancy had done to her body. She had too much going on at once. Worst of all, she was also looking at facing some jail time due to her role in trafficking prescription drugs. She couldn't be taken away from her babies. She just couldn't. Her family claims that her mental health turned from depression to psychosis rapidly. They claim that she became incredibly paranoid. Some of her bizarre behavior included wearing disguises, placing cameras in trees surrounding her home, reporting that people were watching her and following her, and she even expressed thoughts of suicide. Judy's family became so concerned about her behavior that on March 2nd, 2000, a little over 3 weeks before the fatal crash, they had her involuntarily committed to the psychiatric unit at St. Francis Hospital. There, she was diagnosed as suffering from a major depressive disorder with postpartum onset with psychotic features. They put her on Risperdal, an antipsychotic drug, and she was also diagnosed with hyperthyroidism. Postpartum psychosis is a rare but dangerous condition. It only occurs in 1 or 2 per 1,000 women who give birth. And of those 1 or 2 women, only 4% end up committing infanticide. Early symptoms of postpartum psychosis include mania, restlessness, irritability, and insomnia. If left untreated, the psychosis leads to delusions and hallucinations. They center around the child, so the mother becomes hyperprotective, believing that someone, or something, is out to harm her child. Often, the mother goes through a process called merging, where she can't differentiate where she ends and the baby begins. Psychology Today talks about merging in the article Moms Who Kill, and state that psychotic merging becomes dangerous when the mother attempts to stop the loss of herself by either committing suicide or infanticide, also known as suicide by proxy. Psychotic merging is what happened to Andrea Yates. She deliberately drowned her 5 children in June 2001 after multiple suicide attempts. In her mind, killing her children was a way of protecting herself from further harm, since there is no difference between killing herself and killing her children. Clearly, postpartum psychosis is a complicated psychological disorder that needs to be taken seriously. The Risperdal helped Judy's psychosis, and on March 4th, 2 days after she was admitted, she was released from St. Francis. What we don't know is if she stayed on her medication after leaving the hospital. Whatever relief Judy had from her psychosis, it was short-lived. If you're wondering why she was able to leave early from a 3-day hold, it wasn't a 51-50. 51-50s commit a person to a psychiatric facility for about 72 hours. They do not get the option to check out early, like Judy did. The timeline of March 25th, 2000 has been pieced together by investigators through Judy's family members as well as countless other witnesses. It is as follows. At 11:30 a.m., Judy, who was accompanied by nephew Jeremy Young, who was celebrating his 10th birthday, drives to her sister's home to pick up her children, Joni, age 9, Jacob, age 5, and Jordan, age 12. At noon, Judy arrives at the home of her sister, Janetta Scott. Judy leaves around 2 p.m. with all 4 of her children. And Janetta felt something was wrong when they all stopped at McDonald's to get something to drink. Something inside of her told her she needed to follow Judy and keep an eye on her. She made up the excuse that she wanted to buy Jeremy a toy for his birthday. So Janetta follows in her car as they drive to Toys R Us. It would be the last time she sees the children alive. At 2:30 p.m., Janetta loses track of Judy when Judy stops in traffic. The stop forces Janetta to go around Judy. She turns around to go back, thinking Judy is having car trouble, but she's unable to find her. Judy had driven off as soon as her sister turned the corner. Sometime between 3 and 3:30 p.m., a man working in his yard sees Judy when she stops her car in front of his house. He reports that Judy stared at him for a few minutes, came to, and then left. Then between 3:30 and 4 o'clock p.m., 2 women see Judy's car stopped in traffic. They approach her and ask her if there is a problem, and ask her if she needs to make a phone call. She nods that she does, and they loan her a cell phone. But then Judy drives off, and returns 2 minutes later with the phone. She sits in the driveway of the home, staring blankly ahead for 5 minutes. The homeowner had called the police when Judy took off with her phone, but it's not clear if she called them back to say the woman had returned. At 4 p.m., Judy arrives to the Valley Brook Mobile Home Park. There, she enters the clubhouse, where a baby shower is taking place. No one seems to recognize her. Witnesses say that Judy stated, "I need help." When asked what type of help, she replied, "I need a birthday party." People at the shower think that Judy might be looking for a gathering at the park's other clubhouse and give her directions to that site. She would stay at the shower for about 15 to 20 minutes before finally leaving. From 4:10 to 4:45 p.m., there are no reported sightings as Judy drives the 21.5 miles from the south side of Indiana to Martinsville. At 4:45 p.m., she arrives at the Speedway gas station on the edge of Martinsville. CCTV footage shows her and the children walking into the gas station, paying $3 for gasoline and buying some candy bars. An attendant reported that Judy sat in the car for several minutes before going inside to pay. She was unable to activate the gas pump, so he assisted her. This is the third time that day that someone claims to see Judy just sitting in her car, doing nothing. At 4:55 p.m., witnesses begin reporting a white late-model Pontiac Firebird, which entered the southbound lanes of I-67 at the exit ramp on Pumpkin Vine Hill Road, driving the wrong way on the highway. The car is reported traveling at a high speed, with estimates varying between 55 miles an hour and 100 miles an hour. One witness describes seeing a small boy in the front seat who looked to be on his knees, his hands outstretched to the dash as if he was holding on, and the driver's blonde hair was blowing in the wind. Other drivers report that Judy does not appear to slow down or take evasive action as she meets oncoming vehicles. At 4:57 p.m., Judy's 1989 white Pontiac Firebird collides head-on with a van driven by Thomas Reel, a 40-year-old father from Martinsville. The collision, described by witnesses as a horrific, spectacular explosion, kills all four children riding with Judy. Also killed are Thomas and two of his children, Bradley Reel, age 13, and Jessica Reel, age 14. All seven were pronounced dead at the scene.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor.
Judy and another passenger in the Reel van, Richard Miller, age 13, are taken to Methodist Hospital in Indianapolis. Judy was arrested upon release, where she was then booked into Morgan County Jail. She was charged with 7 counts of murder, 4 counts of neglect of a dependent with serious injury, and 1 count of aggravated battery by inflicting an injury that creates a substantial risk of death or cause. On April 17, 2000, Judy appeared in person by video from Morgan County Jail, where she entered a plea of not guilty. She elected to hire her own counsel and initially retained defense attorney David Hennessy, but later replaced him with attorney Tom Jones. After numerous pretrial hearings and evaluations to determine her competency to stand trial, it finally began on April 24, 2001. The jurors and court spectators would be shown horrific photos of the carnage that Judy's driving caused. The twisted, mangled, and utterly destroyed Firebird shocked them. About 100 witnesses were called to testify on behalf of the prosecution. Several of them were Judy's own family members, her ex-husband, and father to 5 of her children, Victor Kirby, testified on behalf of the prosecution. He stated that in February of 2000, he noticed the strange and erratic behavior of Judy. She called him, asking him to say that he received all of the items in her house as a part of the divorce settlement. She believed that she was being followed and repeatedly made this request of him. He then traveled to her home to pick up his 2 eldest sons, Josh and Justin, to celebrate Josh's birthday in Kentucky. When they returned, Justin told him that his mother had been planning on taking her life. Justin later denied saying this about his mother. When he was being cross-examined by her defense team, Victor was asked if he believed that Judy hand-picked which children she would take with her that day. He responded with, "I don't think she knew what she was doing." The prosecution asked him to clarify his response by asking Victor if he believed the same about Judy driving on the wrong side of the highway. He stared straight at Judy and said, "She knew what she was doing then." Tinney Kirby, who was Victor's brother and father of 2 of Judy's children, also testified that on the Thursday before the crash, Judy was acting normal and he didn't see anything wrong with her behavior. The prosecution's theory is that Tinney held the drug charges over Judy's head and did not want to have a relationship with her because she had too many children, which caused Judy to then become suicidal. Tinney denied those statements. During closing arguments, Deputy Prosecutor Terry Licoli describes the feeling Judy must have had as she drove almost 2 miles, passing 16 wrong-way signs on the wrong side of I-67. He said, "She had nerves of steel. Imagine that for 87 seconds. Cars coming at you, swerving, trying to get you to stop. 9 vehicles. Judy knows they can't all avoid her. So she goes faster and faster. She nails it." He then paused for 87 seconds to demonstrate how much time Judy had to pull over and save the lives of 7 people. Her defense team stuck with the notion that a thyroid disease was responsible for her actions and that she was not suicidal. Tom Jones said that Judy was a loving mother who was misdiagnosed and improperly treated. She would have never intentionally harmed her children. She loved them. She was just lost in her psychosis. The crash was so horrific that, when asked at trial, many first responders claimed to still have nightmares of what they saw. It's a wonder that anyone was able to walk away at all from that crash. However, the survivors were not unscathed. Judy was thrown from her car and suffered a closed head injury. Richard Miller's injuries have caused permanent impairment of his back and right foot. On May 11, 2001, all parties rested their cases, and the jury began to deliberate her fate. 10 hours later, the jury announced that they had reached a verdict. Judy was found guilty on all counts. On June 3, 2001, she was sentenced to a total of 215 years in prison. Her latest appeal was in 2015. She raised 2 issues to be considered. 1. She received ineffective assistance of trial counsel. 2. She received ineffective assistance of appeal counsel. The court denied her claim, stating that Kirby contends that she was denied the effective assistance of both trial and appellate counsel. The standard by which we review claims of ineffective assistance of counsel is well established. In order to prevail on a claim of this nature, she must satisfy a 2-pronged test showing that 1. Her counsel's performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness based on prevailing professional norms. 2. There is a reasonable probability that but for the counsel's errors, the result of the proceeding would have been different. Based on the foregoing, we conclude that Kirby received effective assistance of counsel, and therefore, the post-conviction court properly denied Kirby's petition for post-conviction relief. Louise Cosery, who lost her husband Thomas and 2 children in that fatal car accident, had this to say about seeing Judy during her appeal hearing. "That was overwhelming to see her again. I don't think her countenance or demeanor has changed. I don't see any forgiveness. Her head was down, that solemn look. I don't think there is any change in her at all. There is just no accountability. And people think when they do something wrong, they can get away with it, or we can find a loophole for you to get away with it. It's not going to happen." Judy remains in the Indiana Women's Prison. She is now 49 years old. Her earliest possible release date is 3/29/2106. She would be 138 years old. I have written to Judy to see if she would like to provide a statement for the show. If she responds, I'll provide an update. This case kind of hit close to home for me. Understanding that postpartum psychosis is a real disease brought me back to a time in high school when one of my classmates, we'll call her Christy, had a mother who was somewhat of a religious fanatic. She would come to class and always say how crazy her mom was and that her mom was really strict with her. And of course, as a teenager, you kind of roll your eyes because you're like, well, yeah, we all have strict parents. Of course she is. And then on September 23rd, 2003, at around 6:30 p.m., Christy's stepfather arrived home. He noticed that the garage door had gotten stuck halfway up, so he had to crawl underneath it. And he saw his wife at the door of their house. She had looked really strange. And she looks at him and says, "Something happened to the girls, and I don't want them to suffer." He was really confused, but he walked through the house and was looking for his 2 daughters, who were 6 and 3 at the time. He later found them in the master bedroom. They were naked, wet, and covered with a blanket. So he immediately, of course, called 911. And he's screaming, you know, that his wife had hurt her. And he said, you know, they're unconscious. There's something coming out of their mouths. I don't know what the heck is going. I don't know what my wife did. Get your ass over here, please. And he's just yelling and crying and screaming, you know, for his daughters to come back. So he paces around the house a little bit in the garage and he starts looking for his wife because he's so angry. And you can hear him on the 911 call saying, you should have seen a psychiatrist and you deserve to die, you're a stupid idiot. But once the dispatcher kind of diverts him back to the girls to see if he can do any life-saving techniques, of course he can't because they're already gone. He ends up, you know, breaking down. The phone call ends, paramedics arrive. She was charged with capital murder for causing the deaths of the two girls, but she was actually acquitted and was found not guilty by reason of insanity. She had never actually been seen by a mental health professional until the trial, where at least I think 6 or 7 of them agreed that she was in a delusional psychosis at the time of the murder. Christy used to say, you know, that her mom was crazy and that she was, you know, very religious. But what later came out was that her mom believed that people in the neighborhood were watching her and that evil spirits were in the house, and that they were telling her basically that the girls were going to die very slowly and very painfully. And so she wanted to spare them that pain. And so her only choice at the time was to murder them. There's a videotape or a YouTube clip, I'm sure, floating around of her interrogation, and she's very despondent, very not present when she's being questioned by investigators. And she describes the killings just very subdued. And then the psychiatrist starts asking her again, you know, can you give me more details? Tell me what happened to the girls. And you see kind of the shift in her, and she starts kind of rocking back and forth and then breaks down and just starts sobbing as if she realized what happened to her children. In any case, she's committed to a mental facility in Texas where she is diagnosed with schizophrenia with psychosis. And she was successfully treated according to the state of Texas. So 2 years after that, so around 2005, 2006-ish, she appears before a Collin County judge who grants her release, and she enters into outpatient treatment. She still had conditions upon her release, so it's not like she was walking out free, but Judy's story really kind of reminded me of that whole situation where you look at somebody who is clearly suffering, but you kind of brush it under the rug. And so for Christy's mom, it was, she's just crazy or this, you know, and nobody actually helped her. Nobody forced her to enter into a mental hospital or something, you know. And I could go on and on about the mental health crisis we have in this country and how, you know, it's hard to find assistance for that. But it really just reminded me of her. It's been about 14 years since that happened. And I remember the week after, you know, her sisters were laid to rest, Christy came back to school and it was life as usual. She was very detached and she kind of went through, obviously, an odd phase. And I don't know if she was getting any help for any of these issues. I hope that she was. But from what I understand now, she's leading a very happy and healthy life, so that's great. I don't know anything about her mother or where she's at. Judy's case just reminded me so much of Christy's mom. When I was talking to Brittany, the assistant researcher on the case, I was just drawing these parallels, so I wanted to share that little tidbit with you. Sorry to go off script. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts It really helps us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast, Instagram TCFC_podcast, and of course, our website is truecrimefanclub.com. If you have an episode request or general suggestion, you can send us an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com. I would like to welcome to the club our most recent Patreon supporters, Heather P., BeKindCallie/JillC, Tawny and George Plattis from the Dirty Bits podcast, Anne Gret, Ashley C., Ariel M., Carol C., Emma Z., Mike Brown from the Pleasing Terrors podcast, Sarah T., Nicole R., Allison M., and Angela S. Our music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Check them out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams. Special thanks to Jillian, host of the Court Junkie podcast, for voicing Judy's intro. You were absolutely amazing. Research assistance and content editing for this episode was provided by Brittany Martinez. Brittany's also going to lead the next full episode. I can't wait for you guys to hear it. To discuss this episode and other cases, head over to the Facebook discussion group. Just search for True Crime Fan Club Discussion Group, and one of our lovely mods will add you.
So all that comes out is, damn, girl. Well, me and my sisters have plenty of those moments, and we're pretty sure you do too. Share them with us at damngirlpod@gmail.com and check out our podcast, Damn Girl. Okay. Bye.